No, she said in a quiet voice. I wasn't buying it. It might be linked to her murder. Telling me what you know could help catch her killer. She sighed. Yeah, all right. She was seeing someone. A guy at work. I don't know the details. Yazzie wouldn't say who he was. But she was really into him. Mr. Big, she called him. You know, like in Sex and the City. Mr. Big. A comment about his seniority, or another reference to penises and performance. Maybe Fontaine really was impotent.
Do you think Tristan suspected anything? Said Frost, cocking her head.
Nagin laughed, the crack of a whip, a smoker's laugh. I guess so. She was talking about leaving him, wasn't she?
Really?
Tristan Fontaine hadn't mentioned that yesterday. The reverse, in fact. He'd made out they were a love story, despite what his body language kept yelling. I thought how he'd kept calling his little boy my son, how he was so possessive over him. An idea formed. If Yasmin left him, he risked losing his child. How do you think Tristan would have reacted? I said. He wouldn't have been happy about it. He dotes on the kid. He grew up in foster care. His mother was a drinker. Always said he wanted stability for his own children. Maternal neglect, difficult childhood, it fitted the profile. Might he have got violent? She laughed again. Him? No way. No backbone, that one. Not that I'm saying he should have got violent, she added quickly. But Yaz definitely wore the trousers at home. She was only a little thing, but as tough as old boots. Really bossed the poor git around. An emasculated male, too. Sounds like it was never the perfect match. She shook her head. To be honest, we all wondered what a girl like her was doing with a fella like him. If you want to know, she said in a conspiratorial voice, I think it started off as a pity shag. And he's clever. Tristan, very bookish. She was drawn to that. Then she got pregnant, and that was it. This Mr. Big was different, though. Couldn't get a peep out of her about him, but she told me all about the sex. Very 50 Shades, if you get my drift. And Yasmin liked that? Said Frost, all prim and proper. I rolled my eyes at Nagin, and she grinned. Course she bloody liked it. Made a nice change to Tristan and the fucking missionary position with his socks on. I couldn't help laughing, not least because of Frost's shocked Catholic schoolgirl expression. Nagin grinned again and angled round to face me. Frigid Frost was out of the circle. You know the really freaky thing, though, she said, pulling a Marlborough packet out of her pocket, more relaxed now. That other girl that got murdered, Lily Abian. She and Yazzie were really good mates. Used to go out together all the time. So not just colleagues, I thought. Friends, too. The odds on the victims knowing their attacker had just gone up. Chapter 43 Scotland Yard, 1645. It was getting dark by the time we arrived back at the Broadway, pelting down too, the noise of the rain competing with the radio. Police still have no leads in the serial murders of Yasmin Pejman and Lily Abian in celebrity hotspot Primrose Hill. This is ridiculous, I said, circling the block for the seventh time, looking for parking. I'll drop you off. No point you getting soaked too.
See you up there, said Frost as I pulled over. I'll get started on the report.
She hopped out with a wave and a smile. She was full of beans, that one. It took me another 10 minutes to find a meter, and cost me nearly a fiver for the privilege of using it. The city tractor in front of me had parked on a double yellow and earned itself a clamp in the process. The last time that happened to me, I'd been hunting down the London lacerator, and I nearly ended up his next victim. A strong wind was starting up as I walked along the back streets to the yard. I hugged my leather jacket tight around me, tucking my hands into my armpits, wishing I'd brought gloves. My head was down, my shoulders hunched against the rain,
so I didn't notice it at first. A car, inching along, just a few metres behind me. My first thought was the driver was looking for a place to park, going slowly so he didn't miss one. But there were no metres along this road, just bus lanes and double red lines. Whatever he was doing, he wasn't looking for somewhere to stop. Was he following me? Or was I being over-suspicious again? Trust may not be my middle name, but paranoia could easily be. A woman in high heels clip-clopped past, a Pret cup in one hand, a folded copy of the Evening Standard under her arm, the headline clearly visible. Scotland Yard gives profile of hillside slasher. And beneath it, a picture of me from the press conference that morning. A close-up for all of London to see. The killer may not know what Falcon or Isaacson looked like, since neither had been at the briefing, but the same couldn't be said for me. I glanced over my shoulder. The car was still there. Maybe I wasn't being so oversensitive after all. I squinted, trying to make out the registration plate. But it was dark and the headlights blinding. The fourth character might have been an S, but it could just as easily have been a 5. The driver was similarly obscured, but I was at least able to tell the make of the car. A BMW 3 Series, black. I reached into my bag for my mobile to call it in when the car accelerated away. Perhaps it was just a coincidence. Or maybe the driver realised he'd been made. Chapter 44. As I rounded the corner, a skinny woman wearing knee-high UGG boots and a duffel coat two sizes too big for her, with the hood pulled up, stepped towards me. "I saw you on the news," she said, twiddling a loose strand of hair around her index finger. "You're investigating that serial killer case, aren't you?" If it hadn't been for her intense stare, I might have brushed her off as a journalist or a drama junkie. But the woman was clearly neither. And on top of that, she looked troubled. Familiar, too. "What's your name?" I said. She shook her head, a quick jerk from side to side, a startled rabbit. She looked unstable. Better to get whatever I could out of her without wasting time on the whole rapport thing. I tried another tack. "Did you want to speak to me about something?" She looked down at her feet, and then back at me, her front teeth grinding her lower lip. "Who was this woman?" "Do you know something about the murders?" I said, trying again. She licked her lips, but still didn't answer. I glanced at her left hand. She was wearing a wedding ring, an engagement ring too. A thought began to push its way to the front of my brain. Married. Nervous. Following the news, and interested in the case. Could it be? "Is this about your husband?" I said. "Why don't you come inside with me? Have a chat in the warm, where you can't do a runner." She pressed her lips together, hesitated, then opened her mouth, about to speak. "Ziba, what a coincidence! I was just coming in to talk to you." I turned round. Standing to my left, out of breath again, was Dan Harper from Scutt and Montong. Talk about bloody timing. "Dan, could you just give me a minute? Jesus fuck, I could have punched the guy. I'd been right about the woman being a bolter. Where the hell was she?"
"Is everything all right?" Harper said.
"Absolutely fine," I said in an icy voice. "What was it you wanted to see me about?"
"I heard some of your lot were over at the office this morning wanting to talk to me. About our conversation last night, I'm guessing?"
There was a definite question in his voice. He was looking for reassurance. "I expect that'll have been it."
"I've been out. I was just passing through the area on my way back in. Thought I'd come to you. I'm sure you all have enough on your plate without chasing me up."
I softened. It wasn't his fault the woman had legged it. "That's good of you," I said with a smile, trying to make up for my hostility a moment ago. "Not everyone would do that."
"Pleased to help," he said, smiling back.
I called the guys who'd been checking things out at S&M and left Harper waiting in one of the soft interview suites we set aside for witnesses. It was only as I was walking away that it hit me like a bullet to the brain. I knew why the woman had looked familiar. It wasn't that I'd seen her before. It was that she was the image of the two murder victims. Chapter 45. Any devs re-sunlight? SMS, 1721. Wolfie's text came through as I was waiting for the lifts. The next briefing was in under an hour. Frost and I would have to bring the team up to speed on our interview with Pejman's sister, and I'd raise what had happened with the runaway bride. But should I mention the incident just now with the car? My instincts had been strong at the time, but could I be sure the driver really was tailing me? Inside the brightly lit entrance hall of Scotland Yard, with the Met's finest going about their day, I couldn't help wondering if I'd imagined the whole thing. It's this business with Duncan's flash drive, I thought with a sigh. I'm all over the place. I need to stop seeing hazards everywhere I turn. I'm not on every serial killer's hit list, for Christ's sake. They look like you, the victims. Have you noticed that? You must be the killer's type. I rubbed my eyes. I needed to pull myself together. My brain was a soup sandwich. It was so messed up. I texted Jack back. Approached handler earlier. Claims he didn't know D. Not sure I'd buy it, though. Spoke to Watkiss, too. Wasn't exactly friendly. And B.O. not letting up breathe a flash drive. How are things with you? SMS, 1722.
Busy. On top of the slasher, a guy's been found hanging at his bedsit. Friend of Dale Redwood from his old children's home. Police haven't ruled out foul play.
Dale Redwood? SMS 1723.
Guy who took a dive off London Bridge. Sure, I told you about his suicide note. Those bastards are to blame for what happened to me, but no one can touch them.
Oh, I remember. And now his mate's dead too. SMS 1723.
Gets worse. He was supposed to meet someone from the Express this morning. Claimed to know who the bastards were, but he never turned up to the meeting. Then a few hours later, the journo gets a call to say the guy's popped his clogs.
Something's up. SMS 1723.
Yup.
You think they got to him? SMS 1724.
Dunno. Maybe Redwood was right. Maybe they are untouchable.
No one's untouchable. SMS 1724. Chapter 46. I should have been focusing on the job in hand, but the drill sergeant in my head wouldn't let up.
Sunlight, it kept saying. Why aren't you doing more?
I may not have been able to trust my instincts about the car just now, but what they were saying about Gavin Handler was a whole other matter. He'd claimed not to know Duncan, but his non-verbals were telling a different story. I could hardly accost him again in the vice room. Watkiss was bound to get in the way if I did, and making an approach away from the yard would likely just get his back up. The phone, though, that could work. Handler had been struck by Cupid's arrow. If I could get him to empathise with my loss, he might be willing to at least meet for a bevy. That would be a start. He picked up on the first ring. Gavin, it's Zeba McKenzie, I said, deliberately using his first name. I'm sorry to bother you again, and I know you don't remember my husband, but I think he might have come across you during Operation Sunlight. I chose my words carefully. Referring to Sunlight directly implied I was in the know.
Sorry,
He was the love of my life. We'd only been married a year. I was there when he was murdered, gunned down in the street like he was target practice. It's been 2 years now, but I still have nightmares.
I'm really sorry, but I can't help. I didn't know Duncan.
He'd used his first name, though.
We'd just come back from holiday, I said, lying my arse off, thinking about the photo on Handler's desk, the one he'd be looking at while I spoke. One minute we're licking ice cream on the beach, the next he's bleeding out in my arms.
Handler sucked his lips down the line. Nearly there.
Look, can I buy you a beer later? You might know more than you think. It'd mean so much if we could just talk.
I made my voice desperate. Something told me Gavin Handler was the sort who'd respond well to a damsel in distress. There was a pause before he answered. I held my breath.
I'm really sorry, he said. I wish I could help, but honestly, there's nothing I can do.
I'd struck out again. Though one thing stood out. Whenever anyone goes on about how honest they're being, you can be sure of one thing. They're not giving it to you straight.
Chapter 47. Briefing Room, Scotland Yard, 1800.
I pulled up a pew at the front of the briefing room. D.S. Silk sat down next to me, tucking his tie into his waistcoat and smoothing down his trousers.
We've got quite a roomful here, said
Isaacson, taking a swig from his Gaviscon bottle as he waited for everyone to settle down.
I won't keep you long, but this is a complex investigation, and it's important everyone's kept up to speed. This morning we shared a profile of the offender with the media and appealed for witnesses to come forward. As of this moment, there have been over 200 calls to the hotline, but no real leads. In other roundups, Axel Montan's cards come up clean, and his wife's not budging on the alibi.
Of course, wives have never been known to lie for their husbands, I thought. Or to them.
Ruddock and Murphy followed up on Dan Harper's claim he saw Lily Abian talking to someone in the bar, but no one's corroborated that.
If Abian had been talking to a man in the bar, someone else would have noticed, so why hadn't they? Was it wishful thinking on Harper's part? Had he just been looking for answers? I've seen this sort of thing before. Shock plays havoc with our memory. Trauma sends the brain into overdrive as it tries to make sense of what's happened.
We've just been speaking to Harper now, said Skinny. We pushed him on details, but he didn't give us much.
Let's park that angle for the time being, said
Isaacson, dabbing his nose with a pressed white cotton hanky.
Frost, can you give us an overview of your interview with Pejman's sister?
She tucked her hair behind her ears and read from the A4 pad in front of her, giving the highlights from our session with Nagin. And it sounds like Yasmin was thinking of leaving her husband and that Tristan knew about it, she said, finishing up and looking at Isaacson, her sheep eyes round and hopeful like a little girl desperate for daddy's approval. He nodded his brisk nod and checked his watch, perfectly acting out the role of impossible-to-impress father.
So, Pejman was having an affair and planning to walk out on her marriage, and it's possible Tristan Fontaine was in the know.
He paused. Where was he going with this?
When initially questioned by the Kentish Town MCU, Fontaine claimed he was out with friends in Hampstead the night she died, and that he got home around 10:30 p.m. His son was having a sleepover with his grandparents, which means there's no babysitter to corroborate the time. And there's no CCTV in his street either, so we can't be sure what time he got back. The MCU got statements from the mates he was with. Both confirm they had dinner together and that Fontaine left the restaurant around 10. Restaurant receipts back that up. However,
another pause.
CCTV footage shows a black vehicle registered to him in Clerkenwell at 11 p.m. outside the office where Pejman worked. It also shows the same vehicle driving at a slow speed up and down the surrounding streets.
A black vehicle driving slowly? Just like the car this afternoon. Should I say something? Or would I look like a nut job?
Settle down, there's more.
Isaacson folded his arms across his chest. his default pose.
As well as being in Clerkenwell the night Yasmin was murdered, Fontaine was also there at the time of Lily Abian's abduction. In fact, his vehicle's been caught on cameras in the vicinity every night since the first homicide.
Trawling for victims? I thought, as the room took a collective breath.
How would you say he compares to the profile, Mackenzie?
He didn't come across as asocial when I spoke to him, but that doesn't mean anything. Plenty of introverts manage normal interactions. He seemed withdrawn, but he'd just lost his wife, so we can't read into that. Though Nagin said Yasmin wore the trousers, so it's possible he felt emasculated. He grew up in foster care, and his mum was an alky, which fits with what I said about a difficult childhood and maternal neglect, and his possessiveness could signal anger issues. I paused. It's hard to call, but yes, he could be our guy. There was a ripple round the room. You can feel excitement. It has a pulse. Isakson nodded. He almost smiled.
We've got good grounds for an arrest, but I want everything buttoned down before we bring him in. Understood?
There were murmurs of assent.
Right then. Silk and Andrews are doing background checks on him now, and we've got a warrant to search his car. In the meantime, Josephs, take Frost. I want you re-interviewing the friends he was with the night Yasmin was killed. Get as much info as you can. His state of mind, what they talked about, if he got up to use the toilet, I want it all. The more we can get on him, the more it'll help when we interview him. I don't need to tell you what it would mean if we can catch him out in a provable lie. All clear? Good. Let's get going, people.
Chapter 48. Blomfield Villas, London, 2047. I was back home making egg banjos after a quick run and a few sweaty rounds with my punch bag when my mobile rang. The number was withheld. Either the caller was using an ex-directory landline or was deliberately covering their tracks. I wiped my hands on a piece of kitchen towel and answered, crooking the handset between my ear and shoulder as I flipped the eggs onto a piece of stale bread. Zeba Mackenzie speaking, I said, squirting ketchup over the yolks and reaching into the Hovis sack for another slice to layer on top. The person on the other end didn't answer, but I could hear heavy breathing down the receiver. Ragged, not the pervy sort, rather a sign of nerves. Who's there? I said in my best coaxing voice. More breathing. You sound scared. What is it? I didn't know who was at the end of the line, but their fear showed it was costing them something to make the call. Could it be Tristan Fontaine? He had my number. I'd given him my card at the end of our interview. Were his demons coming to haunt him? Was he reaching out, maybe wanting to confess what he'd done? I'd empathized with him during our interview. He knew I'd lost my husband. Perhaps he thought we had a bond, that I'd understand him. If Isakson were here, he'd tell me not to say a word without a copper present. But then I didn't go through Hendon. The College of Policing's codes and standards of professional behaviour doesn't much interest me, and in my book, it's always easier to beg forgiveness than ask permission.
Are you alone? Said the caller.
It wasn't Tristan Fontaine. So... Gavin? Is that you? A whisper.
Yes.
Then again,
are you alone?
I? My heart was beating hard. Maybe my read on him earlier hadn't been so far off after all. I'd obviously managed to hit a button. Why else would he be calling? Though what was up with all the cloak and dagger shit?
Can anyone overhear you?
No.
What's your address?
I told him, spelling out my postcode with the phonetic alphabet. No room for errors that way. Whiskey 2, 6 November, Quebec.
Midnight, he said.
Shut your curtains. Keep the lights off. Tell no one I'm coming.
Chapter 49. I hung up the phone, brain buzzing. I was longing to speak to Jack and tell him what had just happened. But a deal's a deal. Wolfie would have to wait. Instead, I gobbled my fried egg sandwich over the counter, runny yolk and ketchup oozing down my chin. What was Gavin Handler going to tell me, and why the James Bond routine? The guy was stressed. I'd already seen that. And he was wary of Watkiss, too. Were those things linked? Is that what this was about? No, it was about Duncan's homicide. It had to be. Handler had intel, and my call to him earlier had made him come forward. I uncorked a bottle of Sonoma County Pinot Noir, poured out a large glassful, and took a gulp without bothering to let it breathe. The wine was soft and plummy, warming my insides as it slid down. I took another slug. But what was the intel about? Watkiss and the suit from the courtyard had been discussing sunlight. Was the operation live again? Is that why they were talking about it? If so, something new must have come to light, and for someone like a civil servant to be involved, it had to be high level, top secret. Did Handler want to tell me to stop asking questions? Was I putting the operation at risk by doing so? Given what I'd found on Duncan's flash drive, I knew the results hadn't been good first time round. Maybe this was the team's last chance to nail it. That could well explain Gavin Handler's stress levels, Watkiss's behaviour towards me, and the need for concealment now. If so, I wasn't going to be given information, I was going to be shut down. I wandered into the living room, wine glass in one hand, bottle in the other. The radio was on as usual, set for the news. I wrapped the chenille throw from the sofa round my shoulders and curled up with my drink, listening to a commentator I didn't recognise bang on about the latest developments in the Hillside Slasher case. At once, the guilt started nagging again. I shouldn't be spending so much energy investigating Duncan's homicide, I thought, not when I'm on an active investigation with such high stakes. Duncan had been dead for 2 years. Holding back for a few weeks won't make any difference. And yet I knew I was in too deep to let things lie. Once I start digging, I don't stop till I've got a hole big enough to stand in. Though what did that mean for the Primrose Hill case? What might I miss with my attention diverted? I pointed the remote at the stereo and turned up the volume, drowning out the thoughts sloshing round my head with a stranger's voice. Was Tristan Fontaine listening to this programme too? Was he enjoying the media attention? I set my glass down on the coffee table and leaned my head back against the sofa, yawning. It had been a long day, but it wasn't over yet. I'd get no rest tonight.
Chapter 50. I'm Munch's scream. I'm crying out for help, only no one can hear me. And even if they did, no one would believe me. Your husband, so perfect, they'd say. You're letting your imagination run away with you. But it's the only answer that makes sense. What I've found, what he's doing, I can't think about anything else. I wish I could go back to obsessing about my weight and what happened with Noah, like I used to before all this started. I truly do. Not that that was great either. I'd torture myself for hours on end, remembering every detail of him, painting him in my head, the mole on the small of his back, the soft swell of his buttocks, his blue eyes, so dark, they were almost navy. Then the warmth of his skin, the weight of his body on mine, and the horror of my husband coming home early and finding us. I did it deliberately, consciously summoning up the memories as a form of punishment, retribution for what I did. Penance. But if I'm right about the newspaper clippings and everything, then it's getting dark. How long have I been crying? I've lost all track of time.
When I got my place at Goldsmith's, it felt like a ticket to another life. I'd get to put an ocean between me and my mom and start over. But now it seems I just swapped one hell for another. Because my husband may be spying on me, but I'm not the only one he's watching.
Chapter 51. Bloomfield Villas, London, 2315. On the radio, a psychic was saying that whenever she looked at photos of Yasmin Pejman, she heard the sound of water pouring. I've offered my services to the police. I think I could add real value to the investigation.
Course you could, love, I thought, switching it off.
I was thinking about my interview with Tristan Fontaine and about the nature of the attacks. Something didn't fit. I'd profiled the offender as impotent, which explained the excessive stabbing, and if Fontaine was our guy, it's possible the womb aspect of the signature was linked to his anger about Yasmin trying to take his son away from him and break up their family. That all made sense. Thing is, if Fontaine was the perp, then that meant Pejman's murder was a personal cause homicide. But if his wife was the true target of his rage, then why go after Lily Abian? Nagin Pejman had said Yasmin and Lily were friends. Did Fontaine blame her for his wife mattress dancing with Mr. Big? Had she introduced them? And if so, was that really motive enough for murder? I heaved myself off the sofa and padded through to the kitchen to fix some coffee. It wouldn't be long before Handler got here, and my brain needed sharpening up. When I came back into the living room, my mobile was flashing with a text from Jack. Some Agatha Christie quote about fear being incomplete knowledge. I was messaging him back. What's this obsession with fear quotes? When I stopped. Could that be the answer? I rang him. What was that Agatha Christie book you were going on about the other day? Hello, how are you? Is conversation filler for people who have nothing to say to each other. Huh? Oh, you mean the ABC murders? Yeah, it's brilliant. You should read it. Though it wasn't the other day, it was weeks ago. A not at all veiled reference to how I'd been avoiding him before everything with the flash drive kicked off. Remind me what it's about, I said. There's this serial killer working his way through the alphabet. A is for Mrs. Asher in Andover. B is for Betty someone or other in Bexhill. You get the idea.
I meant the twist.
Ah, that. It's pure Christie genius. You sure you want me to ruin it for you?
Quite sure.
Suit yourself, but I warn you, you're missing out.
Jack!
All right, keep your wig on. Turns out the killer wanted to do his wife in, but knew that if he did, he'd be the obvious suspect. So instead, he kills a whole bunch of other people to make her death look like the work of a serial killer and deflect attention from him. There's this brilliant line at the end when Poirot figures it out. You're less likely to notice a pin when it's in a pincushion, or an individual murder when it's part of a series. Isn't that great?
And deflect attention from him. Tristan Fontaine had dozens of Agatha Christie's on his shelves. True crime books, too. Could the fact it made no sense for him to kill Lily Abian be the very reason he'd done so? One day earlier. Friday. Chapter 52. Bloomfield Villas, London, 0113. I paced up and down the big Persian rug in my living room, frustration building. Where was Handler? He should have been here over an hour ago. I pulled back the curtains and scanned the street. There was a fox strutting along the pavement like he owned it, his bushy tail bobbing up and down, but otherwise the road was dark and empty. Had Handler written down my address wrong? No, that didn't chime, given all his precautions. I thought back to the other day when I'd watched him writing at his desk. How meticulous he'd been. This wasn't a man who'd screw up on basic details. There had to be another reason for him not showing up, but what? Maybe his girlfriend was still awake,
and he couldn't slip away. No, that didn't make sense either. He'd set the time, so he must have been sure he could be here when he said. I hate feeling out of control, not seeing the full picture. Being dependent on someone else doesn't come easy to me. I checked my watch for the nth time. Where was he? Something wasn't right. I could feel it. If only I had his mobile, I could have called him. Should I look up his home number? I could probably pull his address off the electoral roll and take it from there. No, bad move, I thought, halfway to my laptop. He wanted to keep our meeting secret. If he was at home and with someone, I risked pissing him off and blowing the whole thing. I checked my mobile again for missed calls or messages. Nothing. Just that Agatha Christie quote about fear being incomplete knowledge. She's got a point, though, I thought. I was stressing out because I didn't have all the facts. Patience is a virtue, Ziba, my lovely mother would say when I was a kid. Virtue is a grace. Rumi, the Sufi mystic I used to read with my father, came up with something much better. He said it was about having faith in what's to come, about looking at a bare thorn bush and anticipating the rose. It was a beautiful poem. I recited it to Duncan not long before he was killed. We were up early, rambling on Hampstead Heath. The forest floor was thick with acorns and autumn leaves, the sky a brilliant blue. We weren't patient, he said, pulling me in for a kiss, alluding to the fact we'd rushed off to get married after only a few months together. Bah, patience is overrated, I said, kissing him back, though life's taught me otherwise. It goes hand in fist with preparation. Ask any soldier, and they'll tell you the same thing. If you're in a fair fight, there was something off with your planning. I was just thinking perhaps I should give up and get some kip while I still could when my mobile started ringing. About time! Except it wasn't Gavin Handler. It was D.I. Isaacson.
We need you down at the yard, he said. We've arrested Tristan Fontaine. The boys are booking him in now.
Chapter 53. Major Incident Room, Scotland Yard, 0205. It took longer than it should have done to get to the yard at that time in the morning, thanks to my car's battery dying on me. Somehow I'd managed to leave the lights on, and with no one around to give me a jump start, I had a long walk. NSY was morgue quiet when I finally got there, but the incident room was brightly lit and buzzing. I didn't need to be a profiler to read the mood. You could have shot the excitement, it was so thick.
I can't believe it, said D.S. Silk, grinning like a new recruit on his first day of shore leave as we formed a horseshoe around Isaacson. An arrest so soon!
He wasn't the only one smiling. None of us had expected a win this early on.
Let's get started, said Isaacson.
He was wearing a fresh shirt, but the nick on his cheek showed he'd shaved in a hurry, and although his damp hair indicated a recent shower, he was giving off a faint chemical smell.
I realise there hasn't been much sleep going on round here, but the custody clock's already ticking. CSIs are at Fontaine's house now, collecting footwear and clothing, but we need to get our strategy right if we're going to get a confession out of this guy before forensics come back.
He'd have made a good soldier, I thought. He even had the rod up the arse posture. A bit more swearing, and he'd be right up there with the best of them.
I'm going to give you a run-through of where we are with the suspect, and then I'll hand over to Mackenzie so she can advise us on interrogation tactics. We've got hold of Fontaine's vehicle, though it'll take a bit of time before we hear back from the lab. Obviously, what I'm most interested in finding out is whether there are traces of either victim's blood in it.
Again, I wondered whether I should mention the car that had been following me yesterday afternoon. But then again, if Fontaine was our guy, what was the point?
Frost and Josephs have spoken to the people Fontaine was with the night Yasmin was killed. The overall consensus is that he was a bit subdued, not his usual cheery self.
So, Tristan Fontaine's usually upbeat, I thought, chewing my lip. Odd. It was off kilter with the profile. The crimes pointed to an offender who was withdrawn and unsure of himself. Not a happy chappy.
To recap, we know Yasmin Pejman threatened to break up the marriage. We know Fontaine was in Clerkenwell around the time both victims were abducted from the area. And we know he doesn't have an alibi for the time of Pejman's murder.
Frost raised a hand, her biro angled at the ceiling. Put her in pigtails and she could have been back at school. If the first motive was about retaliation, where does Lily Abian fit in? What's the motive for killing her?
May I?
I said to Isakson. He looked a tad surprised, but gave one of his curt nods, and I aired my Agatha Christie theory about Fontaine killing Abian to throw suspicion off himself for Yasmin Pejman's homicide. It's just speculation at this stage. We'll know more once we start questioning him.
Which brings us nicely on to interrogation strategy, said Isakson. Over to you, Mackenzie.
Chapter 54. I've had plenty of practice with interrogation, both in the field and back on the block. And although the subjects and situations have been different, my underlying strategy has always been the same. In every case, I analyse my target and try to work out what would get to them. What's their weak spot? Everyone has one. Doesn't matter how tough you are or what you do for a living, we're all vulnerable. We all get unstuck when pressure's applied in the right place. So for me, the question is always, where's my subject's softest part? Where do I ram in the knife? And that's where the profile comes in. Understand the crime, understand the offender. Understand the offender, understand how to play him. I'd studied the killer's work. I'd interviewed Fontaine. I couldn't be sure yet if he was the perp, but I did know how to find out, and it'd involve using a tactic right out of ex-FBI chief John Douglas's rulebook. In an interview situation, a man like Fontaine will appear to cooperate, but you won't break him easily, I said. He confesses, his life goes down the Kazi. It's the middle of the night. That's a good thing. No one's seen him be arrested. The media vans aren't outside the building yet. That'll put him somewhat at ease, which will make him more susceptible to questioning. So, ease him in slowly. Call him by his first name. Make small talk, get him to drop his guard, but also show him there's nowhere to run. Stage the room, pile up stacks of files on the table with his name on the front, in black marker pen. They can be full of blank pages, it doesn't matter, he won't be seeing what's in them. They just need to look full, and every so often, you need to open them as if you're checking up on a point. Let him see what he's up against. Let him sense the evidence against him. Stick crime scene photos up on the walls, copies of the PM reports and stills from CCTV footage, even if he's not in them. Paper the place with evidence. Show how far-reaching the investigation's been. In knife homicides, it's impossible for an offender not to get the victim's blood on him. We don't have forensics yet, but that doesn't mean you can't bluff. Look him in the eye and say, CSIs have been searching his house while he's been in here. Ask him why they've found traces of blood. Tell him we don't want to know if he did it, we want to know why. He thinks he has everything to lose by talking. Make him believe he has everything to lose by not talking. Offer him a deal if he cooperates, but tell him it's time sensitive. Say he has an hour to talk and then it's off the table. Tell him his confession could be the difference between being out of prison in time to see his son married and never meeting his grandkids. Empathise with him. Project the blame onto Yasmin. Give him a way to save face. Help him to come clean. But this is the most important bit. Put an item of Lily Abian's clothing at a 45-degree angle to his line of vision so he has to turn his head if he wants to look at it. Say nothing about it. Don't draw attention to it. You won't need to. If Tristan Fontaine is the killer, he won't be able to ignore it. His reactions will tell you everything you need to know about his guilt. Chapter 55. Observation Room, Scotland Yard, 0304. I was sitting in the obs room, positioned in front of the monitor next to D.I. Isakson. He'd just dropped a Barocca tablet into his water and was going through his notes. The interview room had been set up exactly as I'd specified. The walls were covered in crime scene images, CCTV stills and extracts from reports, with sections circled or highlighted with a fluorescent marker. And on a small table, at what would be the suspect's 2 o'clock, was a pale blue shirt covered in bloodstains. Lily Abian's clothing, which Fontaine would only recognize if he was the killer. The door opened. Frost came in first, blonde curls and no makeup, chosen because she was the physical antithesis to both victims. Her gentle vibe was exactly what we needed too, a good contrast to hard-nosed Silk. Tristan came in next, head held high, jaw jutting forward, hands clenched. A man who looked ready to fight, rather than capitulate. Like I'd said, getting a confession out of him wouldn't be easy. Silk entered last. He gestured where Fontaine should sit and walked round to the other side, plonking himself down next to Frost and thumping a stack of manila files onto the table.
I must inform you this interview is being audio recorded and may be used in evidence if your case is brought to court.
He flicked through the top folder for a couple of seconds and pointed something out to Frost, who glanced at him and nodded. Nicely done, I thought. The files were full of old computer printouts from the recycling bin, but Fontaine didn't know that. He wasn't paying them any attention, though. Instead, he was staring at the walls, mouth slightly open, rubbing his albino hair with his fat sausage fingers. He was focusing on a picture of Yasmin Pejman, not the photo of her we'd circulated to the media, one from the crime scene, womb ripped out, covered in blood. The corners of his mouth opened, turning into an upside-down smile. It was a limbic response, an almost universal reaction to distress and horror. One that's impossible to fake. And his eyelids were fluttering. Another thing that's hard to simulate. Just like the blood that had drained from his face. Silk read him his rights, and Frost took over the initial questioning. We wouldn't be friending each other on Facebook at the end of all this, but she did know how to follow instructions. I had to give her that. She called Tristan Fontaine by his first name. She eased him into the interview and she empathized with him. But Fontaine didn't relax for a second. He raised his voice. He gesticulated wildly. He protested his innocence every chance he got.
You've got the wrong person, he kept saying. Why are you wasting your time with me? You should be out there looking for whoever did this.
Your car was caught on CCTV in Clerkenwell the night Yasmin was killed. The cameras show it was there every night afterwards. Including the night Lily Abian was killed.
Silk cut in. Fontaine put his head in his hands, a gesture of surrender. I straightened up.
It's not what you think,
he said in a whisper. Why were you there? Said Frost in a quiet voice, mirroring his tone. Fontaine sighed.
Yasmin told me she'd been cheating on me, but she wouldn't say who with. She works all hours, so I guessed it must be someone from the office. I had to know. At that point, I was still trying to save my marriage. The night she died, she'd said there was a work drinks thing she had to go to. She said the do didn't start till late. I arranged for my son to sleep over at my parents'. Grabbed a bite with a few mates to keep me from going mad, you know? Then after that, I drove round Clerkenwell looking for her. I never found her, though. Ended up giving up and going home. Stayed up late, drowning my sorrows. After she was killed, I kept going back to the area. It was a compulsion. I guess I was hoping I could be the hero she never thought I was. I hadn't been able to save our marriage, or her. But maybe I could find whoever did this. Get justice for her. That's what I thought, anyway. Stupid, I know.
His eyes were wet. His voice trembled. It's not stupid, said Frost in the same gentle tone as before. You obviously really loved Yasmin. You must have felt so betrayed when you found out what she'd done. She was empathizing with him. Good.
How do you know her boyfriend didn't do this?
Fontaine said, jerking his head up, his voice suddenly aggressive.
We found traces of Yasmin's blood in your house, said Silk, bang on cue, tightening the screws.
What?
Interesting. There was no neck touching, hand rubbing, or any other signs of discomfort. Fontaine didn't look worried. He looked confused.
In knife murders, it's impossible for an offender not to get some of his victim's blood on him, however careful he's been, said Silk, echoing my words from earlier. The question for us isn't if you killed Yasmin and Lily. It's why you did.
Fontaine slammed his fist on the table.
I didn't kill them!
His voice was loud. He was practically yelling. I tilted my chair back, sucking the tip of my thumb. Because, despite all the evidence, I believed him. Chapter 56. We've got the wrong guy, I said, turning to Isaksson.
They've only just started. You can't possibly know that yet.
I knew almost as soon as they brought him in. The rest of the time, I've been testing my theory. Isaksson pursed his lips. I had some persuading to do. Abian's shirt on the table there. The killer would have been looking at it the whole time he was stabbing her. He most likely held it up as he cut out her womb. And he ripped it open when he posed the body. He didn't take trophies. Instead, every time he relives the crime, he'll picture that shirt. If Tristan Fontaine was the killer, there's no way he'd have been able to stop himself looking at it now. But he didn't. Not once. And he didn't look at the photos of Lily Abian either. His sole focus was on Yasmin. He was horrified by what he saw. And you can't be horrified by something you've already seen. Disgusted, maybe. Upset, possibly, but not horrified.
So you want me to release him because he was more interested in the crime scene photos than a bloody shirt? I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that. And certainly not before we get the lab results from the car.
It's not just the shirt, I said. It was also obvious to me. Why couldn't the DI see it? In interviews, when a person's been accused of something they didn't do, they use their bodies as well as their words to protest their innocence, I said. Their faces become animated, they raise their voices, and they gesticulate like crazy. Tristan Fontaine did all these things, but that's not all. He didn't use pacifiers, the things we unconsciously do to soothe ourselves when we feel uncomfortable. He clenched his fists, he jutted out his chin, he yelled. He was in fight mode, desperate for Silk and Frost to believe him. You can tell if you've got a guilty guy if he shuts up and starts listening closely to what you're saying. Innocent people don't sit quietly. They shout and stamp their feet, just like Fontaine's been doing. Did you notice when he said he didn't kill the victims, he pounded his fist on the table?
Yes.
When people lie, they avoid touching things and their voices drop. The act of deception literally makes their bodies freeze. It's a subconscious response, one they can't control. A bit like trying to smile with your eyes at someone you don't like. Which is how I know I won't be on your Christmas card list, I thought. Guilty people don't shout, "It wasn't me," and thump their fists. I'm telling you, Tristan Fontaine's not our guy.
That's all very well, Mackenzie, but I'm not letting a viable suspect walk free just because the non-verbals are off. If you want to go, that's fine, but the interview's carrying on.
I sighed. Words mean F.A. to me. We're socialized to lie the moment we learn to speak, which is why I've always put more stock in how people react than in what they say. I watch Tristan Fontaine on the monitor now. I noted how he shifted his weight onto his feet, how he leaned forward, how he positioned his hands on the table. I was in no doubt. This was an innocent man. He hadn't murdered Yasmin or Lily. Which meant the killer was still out there, whether Isakson would admit it or not.
Chapter 57.
I don't know what to do. Please help me. My head's filled with these swirling black fears, like a flock of crows is diving inside my brain, pecking out my eyeballs. I made myself believe I was overreacting about my husband's interest in the slasher, even when I found all those printouts about that Scotland Yard woman who looks just like the other victims. And just like me, too. God, I'm such a useless idiot. I should have trusted my instincts. Why was I so blind? Like she said, the killer's wife will have noticed something wasn't right, and I did. But I just buried my dumb head in the sand like a fat ostrich. But I can't do that anymore. Not after what I've just found. OMG. There was blood on his clothes that night, wasn't there? The mark on his shirt. Where is the shirt? It never came through the wash. I've got to find it. You see, now I know for sure. He killed those girls. I have to tell someone. Or I'm next.
Chapter 58. Cafeteria, Scotland Yard, 09:07. Tristan Fontaine was still in interview. I still thought he was innocent, and the DI was still fighting me rather than trying to find the real killer. He'd briefed the team an hour ago on the so-called progress of the interview and assigned jobs. They all involved finding evidence that would catch Fontaine out in a provable lie.
"We lost the golden hour with both homicides," he'd said, a term I'd heard bandied around plenty of times before. The first hour after a crime's been committed is critically important from an investigation's point of view. The offender could still be in the area. Evidence is uncontaminated, and witnesses' memories are fresh. I've heard some DIs say that decisions made in the golden hour can make or break a case. Yasmin Pejman had been found a good 8 hours after she was killed, and we weren't called in to take over from Kentish Town until several hours after Abian's homicide.
"We need to make back the time now," said Isakson. "We have a viable suspect in custody, and we'll be getting the forensics report shortly. I want everyone focused on helping the CPS make a watertight case."
I knew he wouldn't back down over what he'd said in the obs room, but I thought I could at least persuade him to keep an open mind and accept the perp might still be out there, even if he didn't want to let Fontaine go.
"I don't want to hear it again, Mackenzie,"
he'd said, snapping at me in front of everyone. Miserable shit pump, I thought, stomping down to the cafeteria for a Danish. If someone else gets killed on his watch, he'll only have himself to blame. There was a long queue. I'd hit the breakfast rush. There was a strong smell of baked beans and grease, everyone pushing and shoving for trays and grub. I still can't believe Handler had top himself. I'd been reaching for an anemic-looking pastry with a sad splodge of jam in the middle of it. I nearly dropped the plate.
"What did you say?"
I spun round to face the guys talking behind me.
"Haven't you heard?"
said the one nearest me, helping himself to a rubbery-looking fried egg with a lace of dried oil round the edges.
"No."
The blood rushed in my ears. "What's happened?"
"Handler shot himself in the head last night, in his car, signed the gun out of lockup. Everyone's talking about it."
Dead. So that's why he hadn't shown up at my basher. But when did he sign the gun out? Before or after he'd called me?
"I know, right?"
said the guy, misinterpreting the look on my face.
"It's his bird I feel sorry for. They were getting married in a few weeks. She's got a bun in the oven too, so I heard."
Getting hitched, about to become a father, strange time to end it all.